Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour with your host, Carolyn Baker.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the new Lifeboat Hour today, now podcasting every Monday morning and bringing you every week fascinating guests who offer us tools for navigating the very rough waters of our time. We post the podcast on Facebook every Monday morning, and you can also find it at my website at carolynbaker.net. As we talk about the very heartbreaking and turbulent times we live in, we almost always think in terms of humans. Most listeners to this podcast understand that we're potentially facing near-term human extinction by the end of this century or sooner, but unless we're tuned into the more than human world, we tend to think of extinction affecting mostly humans. Just this week, we saw several versions of the same story on the internet informing us that because of climate change, clouds are tending to increasingly drift toward the poles, which of course means that there will be less and less shade, less and less moisture, and more exposure to raw sunlight. So because I'm so committed to making life easier for other species in the wake of catastrophic climate change, I wanted to have someone on the show today who I consider a rock star in the area of animal rescue and who is practicing sacred activism in doing so. Not only is this woman doing amazing work in animal rescue, but she is at the same time very committed to experiencing and expressing beauty in her life, and she's going to be talking about both of these endeavors with us today. She's truly doing what I constantly plead for all of us to do, which is to make it easier on other species as ours continues to destroy this beautiful planet, and to also create beauty whenever possible, as so much of our natural beauty is slipping away. Now, most of you know that Andrew Harvey is the originator of the term sacred activism, and many of you have read his book, The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, or perhaps you've attended his workshops or have heard his talks online. Our guest today has worked closely with Andrew for a number of years and lives bone marrow sacred activism in her world. I'm talking about Jill Angelo, who's worked for nearly two decades in business management before changing her life's direction to pursue an inner calling. For the past decade, she's traveled extensively, studying and working with a number of leading spiritual self-help authors, including Carolyn Mace, Marianne Williamson, Andrew Harvey, Matthew Fox, and Mona Lisa Schultz. She practices creating sacred spaces, and that practice combines her business acumen with spiritual altruism and represents an amalgam of the sacred places she visited and the myriad luminaries that she's worked with. Her inspirations have led her to create a consulting business for veteran, first-time, and self-published authors, and Your Space of Grace, a successful, divinely inspired retail business featuring reasonably priced, vintage, rustic, recreated, recycled furniture, and sacred candles and scrubs. And a little later in the podcast today, she's going to tell us why this is important. Native to Chicago, she lives with her husband Scott and their pack of rescued dogs. Jill Angelo, welcome to the new Lifeboat Hour.
I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, as a life coach, Jill, I work with many people who are waking up or have awakened to the global crisis and want guidance for leaving jobs that are not only not feeding their souls, but in some cases, murdering their souls. They need to make a living and support families and such, but they want to do this in a way that honors their deepest calling. And often, they're just beginning to discover what that calling is. Some years ago, when you were working in the corporate world, you began to feel a calling to something far beyond that world. Tell us how all of that evolved.
Well, my situation might be a little bit different than most, and then again, maybe not. Callings aren't something we usually sit around and discuss, right, because it's such a private thing.
Right.
I had worked for this great, wonderful family in a suburb of Chicago in a manufacturing organization. And I pretty much grew up there. I learned a lot. And for that, I'm grateful because that helped mold where I'm at today. And during all this time, I had lived with a guy who literally was his own rock star. And we had quite a relationship. And I guess if you want to make God laugh, you tell him your plans.
Right.
And I told God that I was going to marry him and we were going to have twins because twins ran in his family and we were going to live in this suburban house. And his mom was going to live with us because he was Italian and all that family stuff. And this is what was going to happen. So we buy this house, and that was through a whole level of synchronicity and serendipity. I had driven past this house for years, always had my eye on it. Then one day, go figure, it's for sale. And in 6 hours, we own the house because that's how it works. So I figured, well, why wouldn't the rest of it work this way? So we decided to get engaged. It was a surprise, and we were there. And day 13, he asked me to marry him. And, of course, I said yes. And then day 14, we were getting ready to go to work, and he was totally not himself and completely an about-face different person from the evening before. And so I said, what's wrong? What's going on? And he said, you know, something's not right. I feel like the other shoe is going to drop. And I said, you know, talk to me about it. And he's like, I don't know how to explain it. I just feel it. So I did my best to reassure him. Off we went to work, and he called at 1 o'clock, told me he loved me. He was on his way home because we had stripped this house. It was a fixer-upper. And unfortunately, through a series of circumstances, he died in a 5-car accident that day. And that is what catapulted my life into questioning everything. Who am I? What am I doing? What's my purpose? Why did this happen? And you go on that seek and find of answers. And then suddenly you become this sponge, right, where you're extrapolating as much information as you can from as many areas as you can to understand what happened. And that's when it proved to me how short life was. And as much as I loved working with this company and these people because they were so good to me, I wanted more. I that structure of 9 to 5 was hard for me. I'm a free spirit. And although I had all the freedom I could have in that company, I still felt in my own personal way trapped. And it had nothing to do with any of them. It was all within myself. So I took a major leap of faith through another series of events in a period of time. And off I went, sold my house, moved to Arizona. That fell apart, moved back to Chicago, started my own business. And in that process, I found out what I was looking for. And that, in a very long answer to you, is working with animals. And so I've always grown up with them. I've always been surrounded by them. You may hear them in this interview. I'm sure you might already. I've got two of them with me right now. My husband and I live with 9 dogs at the moment, a cat and a dog. A cat and a rabbit. And if I could have more, I would. I really would. That calling is, it's in your blood. You know, you feel it. You can't be without it. You want it. And that's where I'm at with animal rescue. And so I'm sure we'll talk about this more. I now work in an animal shelter.
We definitely will talk about it more, Jill. I was just thinking as you were telling this amazing story, how, you know, the death of someone close to us often takes us down a completely different path. And I know that happened for me at the age of 28, and it's happened with so many people because, you know, the paradox, it seems to me, is that death often, you know, puts in our faces how important life is. And
absolutely,
we really want to take a look at what does it mean to be alive and human in a body? And what am I going to do with this precious time that I have left?
Exactly. And it wasn't that I couldn't have finished out the rest of my life, most likely working at this company. I'm sure I could have. And I'm sure a great majority of me would have loved to. I know, though, that seeker in me, because of that death, would have been, well, what else is out there? And that's not to compare where I was. It's kind of like the both and. But I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly. I wanted to find what else could there be. Is, you know, you hear, his death catapulted my spiritual path too. So you hear all these phrases about seeking and finding and what's my calling and what's my purpose. And up until that happened, I had no idea what any of that even meant.
Right.
But once I had no life, once I didn't have him, and, you know, I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, God, you and I talked about this. And I was like, no, Jill, you told him what you wanted.
Yeah.
And then he's like, guess what, girlfriend, that's not the way it's going to be. It was this whole floodgate of grief and determination and fear and empowerment. And it's like you had that paradox, right? The dark and the light, the good and the bad, the sad and the happy. And you just keep walking the path. And it was amazing how supported I've been throughout that entire path. And I think that's one of the biggest telltale signs when you know you're really fulfilling your calling. Things just start coming out of nowhere. And you're like, wait a minute. I just talked about that the other day, and bam, here's this opportunity.
Right, right.
Here's this person who knows someone, or this dog needs a home, and this person just suddenly needs to have that dog. That's the most incredible feeling of all, is when you know you're doing it. And it doesn't seem like it takes an effort. I don't ever feel like I'm swimming upstream. I feel a tremendous amount of grief being in a shelter for all the things I see. But then I laugh and I cry at the same moment again, because while this might happen, another dog will find a home. And it just keeps moving. And I love that kind of effortless feeling, although a lot of work, and that's another paradox, of knowing that I'm doing it and I want to. You know, when you get up and you're like, I want to do this today. I want to do this. I want to help animals find homes, or I want to find this farm, or you know what I'm talking about.
I do know, because every day that I get up, I can't wait to do the work that I came here to do.
And amen.
Really amen. Exciting, huh?
It is. It is. And to make a difference. And to make a difference. And sometimes, and you and I are friends on Facebook, so it's one of the things that I had put up. The other day, a couple weeks ago, I had been delivering animals, because that's one of my jobs at the shelter, and I was delivering animals, and I went to one of my favorite places to get my absolute favorite iced coffee, because as I speak right now, I'm jacked on iced coffee, because it's my addiction, and I was in my clothes from the shelter, and bless this girl behind at the counter who served me, she supersized me because I worked in an animal shelter, and it was the most simplest thing, and that's the stuff that means the most, is the simplicity in what you're doing. Because they're never, at least in my experiences, and I'm sure many would say, I don't know that while fulfilling the calling, they're always these earth-shattering, monumental things. They're these very simple things that are such blessings and graces from God that you're like, yeah, I know I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how wonderful this woman saw the work that I do and said, you know what, we're going to supersize you today. Those are the things that make it so special.
Yeah, it's the little things that really count. They really add up. And you step back and you look at them and you go, wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Jill, you began working with some spiritual luminaries and still are. And
yes.
I'm wondering what it was like to be out of the corporate world and working with people who were doing spiritual teaching. I imagine it was a mix of emotions and outcomes. Can you say more?
It was a mix of emotions and outcomes, because here I come, this green student who doesn't know much about anything except I want to learn and I'm going to call myself that seeker. And now I'm playing ball with the biggest names in the business, right? I didn't even get to T-ball. I went straight to the majors. And I'm blessed for that, because so many of them have given me such great lessons in either their work, in our conversations, in moments where I broke and I reached out and said, guide me, help me, I don't know, what does this mean? And they've all been right there. And each one has given me numerous different gifts on this path. And you're right, because the other side of it is that when you start to develop that relationship with your shadow, because when you're on that spiritual path, that's when you really start to learn what your shadow is. Not that you shouldn't be aware of it prior, but I think when you claim that spiritual path, or you're going through trauma or grief, it stirs up all that dark emotion.
Absolutely.
Where you need to learn that about yourself. And that was exciting for me. And I know that must sound strange, but I love shadow work. I do. I want to know more about the dark side of myself than the light side, because once I can be in check with that dark side, the light side just automatically, in ways it does just appear. It's there because I've cleared out or accept or know what it is that makes me, quote, tick. And that's been a great benefit too. And all those amazing luminaries have helped me get to that point.
Yeah, and you know, I'm so glad you said that about the shadow, because so much of my work and Andrew's work is about the shadow, and it's like when you're committed to doing shadow work, that's when you really find the light, and I think you find it in ways that you couldn't possibly have found it if you were just, okay, now I'm seeking the light, right?
Agreed. Well, then you'd be on a mountain, and you'd have nothing to do with anybody else, and you know, you wouldn't be interacting in day-to-day life. It'd be too difficult. And there are those that we've all crossed paths with, and bless them for where they are at that moment. But I personally would rather have the opportunity to deal with the fact that a perfect stranger just triggered something in me in the store because of the grocery line, and I need to take a look at that. What was that trigger? Where did that come from? And oftentimes we just dismiss it. But those are such key, beautiful gems to have a look at and go, wait a minute. This is important stuff here. And if I can get it, if I can figure this out and get a grasp on it now, how much more freedom am I going to have moving forward? Because I'm not going to be facing that trigger every time.
Yeah, and you know, it's rough being a human these days, but it's also very exciting in many ways, in the ways that we're talking about right now.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, one of the things I'm really fascinated that you do is every year you travel to Africa with Andrew, and you spend time with the white lions on Linda Tucker's White Lion Sanctuary. I'd like you to tell us about how these experiences have impacted you.
Sure, I'm delighted to. Linda has a little bit about Linda for those that don't know. Linda's calling was to be with these lions, and Linda actually was in marketing and advertising and did some modeling in London. I believe she's a Cambridge graduate. So she had quite the life for herself in England and had gone on her own spiritual journey, which led her to South Africa. And through a series of events, like it happens when you're on your path of your calling, she had been called back. She's a dear friend of a mutual friend of Andrew's, and Andrew had suggested, let's go down there. Well, who thinks in their lifetime they're going to go to South Africa and you're going to live literally in lion lands in a beautiful landscaped area that's electric fence, so we're protected, but we're living with the lions. The lions are not living with us. And that's one thing that you have to make that massive adjustment for, because when you see where you're staying in this piece of land in conjunction to the fact that we're on hundreds and hundreds of hectares of land, you see how small life, how you are in the full imprint, right? So we get there, and it's a beautiful fall day, and we're standing talking around this fire pit because it's very, very simple down there, and we don't have electricity so much, and we don't have phones, and the light is kerosene light, and it is pitch black at night, and I mean pitch black that you cannot see your hand in front of your face, and you see the whole, all my dramatic here, but it's so true. The entire sky looks like it's been dusted with pixie dust, all stars, and it is beyond breathtaking. And then you hear this noise, and you kind of look and you go, what's that? And then you hear more, and you hear more. And suddenly you hear this entire pride of lions roaring and communicating with each other. And sometimes they're close enough that you can actually feel, and I've had that opportunity where I have felt those vibrations go right through my body. And that's almost difficult to communicate, to be 25 feet away from that lion and have that lion roar with such power that you're vibrating yourself. It's going right through you. The land is magical. It is magical. For all the earthy people listening, if you think you felt the ground by standing on bare feet, you have to stand on these South African lands and feel the tingle and the firmness and the mother, as Andrew would say, come through you and speak to you. And then you couple it with the native people who live there and work, who have hearts of gold, who can't wait to serve and be with you and eat all that traditional food. And the whole put it all together has made me such an activist again. And the sad part is that these animals are trophy hunted. Lindas are saved. They're on sacred grounds. But there are breeding camps in South Africa where these majestic creatures are bred to be shot for hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not thousands of dollars. And that is where the passion in me comes again, because we bring people down there to educate them so that they can learn and see what it's all about. Because we here in America, we got a general idea of what trophy hunting is in some ways. But down there, it's for sport. It's an income. It's a revenue stream. And it's heartbreaking because they are beyond incredible.
Well, thank you for that detailed description, that heartbreaking description. And I know that you were an animal lover before you ever met Andrew, but mm-hmm. I'm sure that his passion for sacred activism and then his book, The Hope, had a powerful effect on you in terms of your passion to help animals. So why did you want to work at an animal shelter? Tell us how that unfolded.
Having rescued animals pretty much as long as I can remember, that seed still, that fire is still usually maybe a little dim, but then it gets bigger, right? And I had been working at a job that the company had closed. It was a part-time job. And again, through the grace of God and how those things all happen to happen, the gentleman that I had been engaged to briefly, who passed away, we had a mutual friend. And through the glory of Facebook, we reconnected, and she said, let's meet for a drink. So I met her for a drink, and then I find out she works at this animal shelter. So bless her heart, the business I had been at closed on Saturday. I called her on Monday. We were for drinks basically by Wednesday, and the next week I was at the animal shelter. And it happened just that quick. And again, I think that that's another indication of how that calling works. Everything falls into place. So she had called me. I went in. I interviewed. And I am, would you like me to tell you about what I'm doing there? Is this a okay time to keep going to talk about what I do?
Yeah, go ahead and speak a little bit about that. Sure.
I have the absolute pleasure of working in the offsite adoption department. So my role with a team of a few other people is we all work together and we help the animals that are either on stray hold that have not been claimed, because there's hundreds of animals everywhere that come in every day to shelters that are considered strays. And hopefully they're microchipped. So this is my public service announcement. Please make sure your animal is microchipped and has a collar with a name and a phone number that's current so we can find you. These animals who come in as strays most often are not microchipped. When they're not microchipped, they're on stray hold. So we're hoping that their families are going to come to our shelter to try to locate them. If they're not claimed or found, then they stay with us, and I help specifically see that the small animals and cats get to local pet stores, PetSmarts, Petcos, others, that they can be adopted off-site. Oftentimes, it's very difficult for people to walk into a shelter for obvious reasons. And so we try to make it easy. Sometimes it's distance. So we have stores that are 20 and 25 miles away that have our animals in there. So people locally can go to that pet store and be able to adopt there. It is such an incredible sense of pride to see these creatures who we've all seen those terrible tear-jerking Sarah McLachlan, please give money advertisements, and it's true. It is that way, and it can be heartbreaking. So to be able to pack up my car and put 10, 15 animals in it and drive it to a pet store and have all those creatures find homes is one of the best, most rewarding feelings, because it takes a village to help those animals find homes. No different than it takes a village for a lot of other things to happen. It truly takes a village for all of us to get those animals into stores. And then in addition to that, we do big major offsite events where we also take the dogs out. And we take the dogs to different pet stores with tents and music and help those dogs find home. And it's a good blessing to see those animals get out of the shelter for the day. We were at one a couple weeks ago, and it was at a car dealership. And they had pools and sprinklers, and they had people grilling. And we had a great turnout, and the dogs were all in the pool. And it was so much fun. I went in the pool too. It was so much fun. And then the hamburgers that were left over, the dogs got to eat. And you could see the difference in them because they got a day of play as well. And I speak from my heart that there's just nothing more rewarding for me to see this happen. And then in addition to that, my husband and I foster. So what we like to do here, because we have such a large pack that has grown, is we take the animals that need more time for healing because so many animals come in. So what we like to specialize in is we take a lot of the emaciateds or the animals that need more downtime and healing or older ones, amputees. So we'll bring them in here and they get on their feet. So right now I have one specific dog that you're familiar with, Carolyn, and her name is Luna.
Yep.
And Luna's named after the moon. And Luna is but a 5-month-old little pit female. She's a black pit. She was thrown from a moving car and she was hit pretty hard by another car. So she had fractures in her pelvis. Her hip and her leg were both broken. So we needed to get that put back together again. And in addition to that, she was starved. So she was a bag of bones. So we've had her since sometime in April now. And hopefully by beginning of August, she'll be available for adoption. Although my birthday is in August and I think she would be a great birthday present. So we'll see where that goes.
Now, I kind of have a feeling that she's going to become yours. I can't imagine not, because I've been following this story on Facebook, Jill.
I love her.
Yeah, I know you do. You know, it was also good to hear you talk about adopting or making the animals available at pet stores, because, you know, with the puppy mills right now, we're getting so many commercials about don't buy animals from pet stores, but you guys are making clear that these are not coming from puppy mills, and I think that's amazing, an amazing way to get them adopted out.
The puppy mills keep the cycle going. The puppy mills really do. And you know, here's another thing for people who are listening. In my experiences of what I have learned, and there's so much more to learn, puppy mills aren't always those big monstrosity behind the scenes situations. Puppy mills are just as easy your backyard breeders.
Right.
And those are actually worse than some of the bigger events because people don't think that that's what they're doing.
Right.
But, you know, a few tidbits. For people who are out there looking for a puppy and want to go to a breeder, the very first thing you want to make sure is that you're getting to see the mom and dad and that the mom and dad are on the premises and that they're near their babies. Because the second you see that they're not, that should spark question. And if they show you a photo, that should really spark a question. Mm-hmm. Because most often than not, that mom and dad are so far in the back, they are a puppy mill. They're in a terrible cage in deplorable conditions, and they continue to breed them and make money off of the puppies. But there's a lot of people who think that having puppies is going to make them a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And for many, they're highly inexperienced, and they don't, and it becomes a great hazard. Those puppies get very ill because they can't afford to give them the shots that they require. And then it's hard for everybody in the community as well. And then what happens is you have all these viable, beautiful purebreds. We have lots of purebreds that come into the shelter that could be getting homes that don't. And that's not to go against the people who do breed. They breed ethically. They breed well. They don't overbreed those mothers. They don't overstud out those fathers. There are plenty of people who do it the right way for the right reasons. So I put them to the side. But the great majority aren't doing it for the right reasons. So there's nothing better than to see a purebred German Shepherd walk out of the shelter. And we get many of them, many purebreds. We don't always have the papers, but that's okay. You know, I don't know that everybody needs the papers, right? You know, a shelter dog loves just as much as the purebred with the papers does. And in fact, most often they love more because they just went through hell and they know it.
Yeah.
They know it.
I'm really glad I asked you that question because your answer was phenomenal. I learned quite a bit in just hearing you talk about that, so thank you. Well, I'd like you to talk about your role at the shelter, but I know that we can't adequately appreciate the need for people like you or the gargantuan job that you're doing there without your giving us a picture of the crisis. And I'm sure that, you know, you live in the Chicago area. I'm sure that the inner city animal scene has its own characteristics, but I'm also sure that it's not that different from other parts of the country. So tell us a bit about what you're up against.
Most often in one direction, we're up against simplicity. If people were to make sure that their animals have a collar with a current phone number and a microchip. And for those that are listening that don't know what a microchip is the size of a kernel of rice. It is injected with a needle between the animal's shoulder blades. For many animals, it doesn't even hurt. For some, it's a pinch, but it's a worthwhile pinch, because if that animal were to get out anywhere, any police department, any veterinary clinic, even groomers, they all have scanners, and they would be able to scan that chip, and then that chip goes back to you, the person. So our crew here, all nine are microchipped. They all go back to me and subsequently the shelter. So if any of our animals got out and found and they were then scanned, my phone would be ringing because people would be finding me to let me know my dog had been found. So that's one thing that happens. Sometimes it's just, it's oversight, or it could be carelessness on the fact that it's summer. More animals get lost in the summer. Kids are home from school. Their friends come over. They don't lock the gate completely. It's not intentional. It just happens. Animals get out. 4th of July is the number one day of the year that most animals do get out, because people want to see the fireworks, but animals can't stand the fireworks. There's just a small group that seem unfazed by it, but the majority of them are really fazed by that. And then we also have situations that happen where you let your dog out, your cat out, they accidentally get pregnant, you don't know what you're going to do because we didn't spay and neuter. And I can't say enough about spay and neutering, because it does cut down the population. And it's hard to see a dog that's gotten lost, that's been gone for a couple days or even a couple hours, come in. These animals are frantic. They want their owners. You know, their owners are frantic. They want their dogs back. That part's heartbreaking. But we see a lot of other things that happen too. We have ignorance where people just don't know how to per se raise a dog, what the best thing to do is. Or there's people like in down south where they think that the way that you do it is you tie them, you put a lock on their neck, you tie them to a tree on a long lead, and that's how you have a dog. And they make them those outside dogs, except they're really social creatures and they want to be with us. And in my situation, all nine of them want to sleep with us every night. So that's how much all of them want to be with us. So for all the sadness that we do see, and I do see, which is tremendous, gunshot wounds, hit by cars, starving, parvo because they didn't get their shots, carelessness and neglect, unfortunate circumstances where people have come upon bad times where they can't take care of them. And I'm glad that I'm in a facility that is able to provide them the care and the nurturing that they need, because many facilities are completely full, and a lot of facilities across the U.S. are full, and that's where we're back to it taking a village to help find these animals' homes. And we work with rescues and get those animals out to their specific rescue. So like the purebreds, for instance, German Shepherd Rescue. Each specific breed has a rescue group too, but we've got senior adoption groups. We've got specialty adoption groups that'll deal with animals that have cancer or cats that have FIV. I mean, it's such a network of people. And I had heard a statistic that said something like a dog needs to be shared 3,000 times on Facebook before you can find it a home.
Wow.
That's some serious work. That's some serious work. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. But most often than not, there's a lot of success behind that too. And that's rewarding. That's really rewarding.
Well, Jill, what's the best way that folks can get in contact with you if they have questions or they'd like to be involved?
They can email me at info@themoondogfarm.com. Which is my and my husband Scott's newest endeavor. We refer to the house here as Camp Jilby, but we've gone to Camp Jilby 2.0 now, and we're calling ourselves themoondogfarm.com. So it's all of it, themoondogfarm.com. The email is info@, and we're actively seeking land so that we can have a much larger parcel so that we can help rescue and foster as many as possible.
So that's info@themoondogfarm.com, right?
Yes, yes. And my phone number is 928-288-6097.
Want to say that one more time?
You got it. 928-288-6097.
Do you sometimes feel alone because you've done your homework and understand the dire predicament all living beings on Earth are facing in a world where our species seems to be destroying the planet? Do you sometimes wish that you had other people to talk with about how we can navigate this crisis together with courage and grace? This is Carolyn Baker, and on October 13, my team and I are beginning an 8-week online symposium entitled Active Love Beyond the 11th Hour. We've gathered a group of luminaries and thought leaders to come together with us online and give us much more than just information about the global crisis. They are going to open their hearts to us and share the tools they are using to face our predicament, and we're going to have the opportunity as participants to dialogue with them and allow them to inspire and guide us. I want you to join us for this unprecedented online opportunity. And if you can't be present for every session live, once you're registered for the event, you'll have access to every recording of every session. This symposium is going to be a launching pad for a whole new body of work my team and I are beginning, which will provide ongoing tools for connecting deeply with ourselves, each other, and the Earth. We want you to join us in launching this exciting endeavor. To learn more and to register, visit my website at carolynbaker.net.
Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Today I'm talking with Jill Angelo, who's making life a bit easier for dogs and cats and other small animals by rescuing them and providing forever homes for them. And she's also written an amazing book that we're going to talk about in a bit entitled Sacred Spaces. But Jill, you know, Andrew is constantly admonishing us to allow our hearts to be broken. Mm-hmm. And I know that with any work with rescuing animals, all of that work is profoundly heartbreaking.
Yes.
So, yes, of course, there are saves and celebrations and happy endings, but so much of the work is painful and one can easily develop compassion fatigue. So I'm wondering how you take care of yourself in the throes of the heartbreak.
When I'm in the shelter and I'm having a moment, there's always a couple that I see that I know. And I'd have a whole lot more if I could, which is like why we started the Moondog Farm. There's one particular cat at this moment that is my guy. He's just my guy. And if I'm having a moment at the shelter, I will go find him and I will spend time with him or one of the dogs that I love, because there's so many. And there's something about walking up to that cage and seeing a paw come at you from a cat, or the cat rub against the bar so you'll touch it, or the dog thump its tail even if it's not feeling so good, because they want just as much of that affection and attention as I do in return. So while I'm at the shelter, that's one of the things that I do. I'll take a time out. I'll go outside. We have plenty of birds around there, as you can imagine, so I can listen to them chirp and whatnot. Or I'll go get in my car and start delivering, because that will bring me back to focus to help me get them into a store. When I come home, though, that's usually when I really, really break. And when some of the really hard cases that we've seen, that so many of us have seen, or the ones where the girls, the vet techs who work in the back doing what they can to save them, and oftentimes there are those that are not saved, that you well up and you're going to lose it. I'll try to save that to come home here. Scott has been a tremendous anchor for me. He's got that calming, soothing, great disposition that's very supportive of a high energy fire force of nature person like me. And I will lay on the bed, believe it or not, and have a dog pile amongst the ones of mine that are here. I go back into it to get myself through it. And I think people may deal in different ways, but that's what I found is best for me. If I go sit outside on the ground and all of my pack come and surrounds me, they know. They know when I've had a really good day, and they know when I've had a really bad day, and that just makes it a whole lot easier. And sometimes the really bad days, they'll all just kind of lick your face or your hand, and other times a couple of them will bring the ball up and say, let's play. And somehow you come out of it. But others that suffer from it because these, you know, I'm not the only one who suffers from compassion fatigue. Nurses and doctors do too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, right? But this is the way that I handle it in being in an animal shelter. But it's in my DNA now. So there's days where I go, I can't handle this. I'm not going to do this anymore. And then the next day I go in earlier. You know, and I have to be mindful of that too, because sometimes it's very, very easy to overdo it. But I have learned to kind of take that step back, and I can give more when I take that step back, right? It's one of the things that I say when I teach on Sacred Space, and that is, what is the first thing, one of the first things that the pilot says when you're on the plane? If the oxygen were to fall down, you give it to yourself and then your children. And so often we give it to the child first instead of feeding ourselves. So I try very, that's the best way that I know how to feed me.
Well, thank you for that answer. You know, I'm on Facebook a lot. I'm online a lot, and I'm involved with different rescue organizations just, you know, as a contributor. And when I hear the horror stories or see the horror stories, I go get my guy named Sammy, and you know, and cuddle up with him, and sometimes cry, and he licks my face, and he knows, like you said, they know, and he's such a great support when my heart is breaking. And that's just me at a distance looking at this stuff online. I can't imagine what that's really like for you up close and personal.
It's had its moments. It really has had its moments. And when I see the effort of the group, of all of us do what we can to help and get those creatures home to their families. Or, I mean, all of us have seen one and gone, I'll take it to its owner on the way home. Because then you find out some of the stories, right? They're a handicapped person. The dog got out. They can't come and get it for hours, but you're on my way home. I'll, if you give me permission and you go through the proper channels at the shelter, I'll take it home for you. We've all done that. We all want to see these animals get homes. And there's, unfortunately, more and more of them. And society is, you know, we're losing respect for everything. The climate, the cities, the people, animals, even materialism. We live in such a disposable world. And I watch people come in and relinquish. And I'm glad I don't work at the relinquish desk. I mean, kudos to my coworkers who can. I don't have that. I don't have the filter now. I look at these people and I know that some of them are on terrible, terrible circumstances. And I have compassion for you for that. When you blatantly tell us that the dog is astray and the dog is not astray and the dog is crying for you. And, you know, I've seen dogs cry. I've seen cats just freak out in those carriers because they have been left. And it's heartbreaking. And I have walked away wiping away tears before. And I'm grateful that I have the people that I work with that understand it, because that's helpful too. And that I can come home to a spouse who understands it, who gives me that place instead of being like, what's wrong with you? Because there are spouses who couldn't understand. And then to have my pack to get me through it. I'm really actually very protected and insulated doing this work by having so many avenues of support, which make it that much easier and harder to keep doing it. And bless Andrew, because it is a heartbreak. And, you know, I get when he says, don't follow your bliss, follow your heartbreak. And there's been plenty of people who have argued otherwise to say, no, follow your bliss. But I think that when you start to do that work, you start to also see that and I hope I can language this right, while this is my heartbreak, it is also my bliss. But I wouldn't have known that. So I think you come through it again, and the heartbreak would be kind of like that shadow part that brings from the dark to the light, right? I'm seeing all this heartbreak every day. I'm participating in getting it out, which therefore makes it the light and my bliss. Did I language that well?
You absolutely did.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much for that. I love the both and that you're telling me about.
It's a both and thing. It doesn't have to be an either or. And when you know you're doing what your calling is, I don't see how it can't be both. And nothing is perfect. So let's get out of fairy tale world because it's not there. Especially living in the world nowadays. I mean, it's just not there. So it's both and.
Yes, it is. And another part of the both and is Moondog Farm. So I want you to tell us about the project.
Moondog Farm, Scotty and I have just, there's so many more we'd like to have here. And you know, just for a little background, we live in 1,000 square feet and 7 of our dogs are in crates. So I've given up furniture. We have a Great Dane mix, and he lives where my living room chair used to be. Living room chair is covered. It's in the garage. But this is the way, and I've had tremendous judgment against me and what's wrong with you. And you know what? My theory is this. Don't come over. I don't need to invite you because if you cannot support who we are and what we're doing, I understand. If you can't, quote, go there, I get that too. But this is what we believe in, and this is what we feel we can give back to the animal world because these creatures don't have voices. They don't have voices. And as I was saying, every day shelters are full. So if Scotty and I can do our part along with the crew of other rescue organizations that we are in alignment with, as well as the shelter, and get a number of them out who are emaciated, who are amputees, and help them and give them a restful space to heal, and then help them find homes and get adoptions through their proper channels, that frees up all that additional space for more strays to come in to keep the system moving. And that's what our goal is. And those emaciated dogs, I mean, like I said in the beginning, Luna came in April. It'll first be August before Luna is probably really ready to find her forever home. That's a long time for an animal to be in a shelter. And we do have animals at the shelter who have been with us for 6 months. And you better believe it, we're doing everything we can to help them find homes. So the Moondog Farm works in conjunction with the shelter that I'm pleased to say I work at, as well as other rescue organizations. And let me just define that a little bit. Rescue organizations are organizations who take on and go into these shelters and say, we are going to be responsible for these animals. And those rescue organizations need foster parents and foster care. And what we do as fosters is we allow and take in those creatures, take care of them, work in conjunction with the rescue. So again, it's another partnership to help those babies find homes. So we're not big enough yet that we can assume all those costs. So that's why fostering is easier. And it's short term. They're not always long term. Sometimes it's 2 weeks. And that's great because then we can help that baby find a home.
So again, folks, the best way to contact Jill is info@themoondogfarm.com. You may not be able to rescue animals yourself, but you can support Jill's work, whether that's a donation or just giving her a shout out and letting her know that you emotionally and spiritually support her work. So Jill, in addition to doing this very challenging work with animals, you practice what I'm always preaching about, which is holding joy and beauty in your heart and your life alongside the pain and suffering. And nothing demonstrates this more than your 2015 book, Sacred Space, Turning Your Home into a Sanctuary. I'd love it if you tell us why you wrote the book and what you're doing with it these days.
I wrote the book because of Andrew, actually, bless his heart. The gentleman that I was with who passed away, as I said, we bought a fixer-upper. So the day that he died, I lived in a split-level home, and that home was now reduced to the concrete floor and the studs on the wall. I didn't even have a ceiling. It was the guts of the electricity. I couldn't sell the house if I tried. And now suddenly, I don't need a four-bedroom, three-bathroom house that my potential future mother-in-law was supposed to live in with me. I wanted out, but there was nowhere for me to go. And, you know, what was I going to do, get on a plane and go somewhere? I was just going to pack up everything and all the grief right along with me, and it would have shown up no matter where I went. So I had to deal, and I knew that. Well, one of the ways that I dealt with my grief was through building a sanctuary to live in, because the only place that most of us really want to be anyway when going through a trying time is home. It's the whole purpose. It's home. It's where you look at these, that I when I teach, I say about how they're houses until we connect with it and we're in alignment with it, and then it becomes our home. And it becomes our home because we invest our dreams and our hopes for the future, potentially children, maybe a small business, big garden, whatever all those ideas that we want to put into it, we infuse those walls and that ground with it, and then it becomes our sacred space. And so one of the things that my book is about is helping people create it. But it's created from the inside out, not just literally, but spiritually. And in order to do that, each chapter, I'm asking you questions and I'm asking you to journal. If I asked you what your favorite color is, you tell me. But if I asked you why it's your favorite color, you most likely will probably pause because you don't give it a lot of thought. So those are some of the questions that are asked, because we see all these beautiful, in the materialistic way of the United States and as well as the rest of the world, but primarily the U.S., we have all these beautiful companies creating these beautiful living rooms and whatnot, and the hottest trend of this and that, and we want to duplicate it, yet it's pretty empty. Because while I can show you this big, beautiful, fluffy sofa, if I looked at that wingtip chair that belonged to your grandmother, that wingtip chair is going to tell me a story. And that's one of the goals. If I came through your home, which is another question I love to ask, if I came through your home and I started picking up items of yours, could you tell me the story? If you could tell me the story behind it, then I know where the sacred value of your life and what you've created is. Many people don't, because they want it to be more superficial so that it looks good, which I have complete appreciation for. But think of how much better it looks when you tell the story and the history behind why you have it. And there's a lot of people who have items that they don't necessarily want to have but feel that they have to have. And that's usually those heirloom items that belong to Grandma so-and-so or Auntie so-and-so, where through generation of generation you feel that you have to keep them. And I just ask people, if you don't want to display it, then don't. But find a beautiful box and put them in this beautiful box, so the next time you're having a gathering and you have to use them, it becomes an event to unpack them. It becomes a sacred thing to unpack it and place it and use it. You'll have a different attitude and atmosphere of what you've created by doing so. And it's important to remember that we all have those two homes we love to go to. So, for sake of names, we could go to Mary's house and Mary's having a party and we think, wow, I can't go to Mary's. I can't wait to go to Mary's. It's always so much fun. And then Susie could be having a party and you think, yeah, I don't want to go to Susie's house. It's always stress. They're always fighting. You know, be mindful of that. If I came into your home, what would your home tell me? Is a happy, calm, nurturing environment, which is what my goal in creating sacred spaces, or is it a place of chaos and stress and anger? How do you nurture yourself in an environment like that? And that was the purpose of why I wrote the book, to help people create a sacred space that costs nothing. Nothing except your creativity and your heart and your knowingness of yourself. You don't have to duplicate any magazine. You could create it with everything that's in your home right now.
Jill, you're one of the many people who demonstrate to me with your life and work how grief and beauty travel together. The horror of the world is so raw and heartbreaking among other species, and at the same time, we all must love and cherish and create every moment of beauty in our lives that we possibly can.
Amen.
Yeah. And your book is available on Amazon or through your local bookstore. That's Sacred Space, Turning Your Home into a Sanctuary. Today I've been talking with Jill Angelo, animal rescuer, shelter worker, and founder of what is soon to be Moondog Farm. I want you to check out her book, Sacred Space, Turning Your Home into a Sanctuary. She's truly making our ecological crisis easier for many animals, and I so deeply appreciate her work. I urge you to let her know how much you appreciate it as well. Contact her at info@themoondogfarm.com. Thank you, Jill, for being with us today. And many blessings to you as you do this desperately needed work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so grateful to be here. And remember, everybody, my last thing, adopt, don't shop. Okay.
Thanks, Jill.
Thank you, Carolyn.
And thank you all for joining us today on the New Lifeboat Hour. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, be well, be safe, and be awake.
Thank you for joining us today. You can hear all podcasts and learn about Carolyn Baker's other works at www.carolynbaker.net. Her daily news digest is available by subscription and is delivered to your inbox 7 days per week with real news on economics, environment, geopolitics, civil liberties, and cultural issues, plus links to articles on inspiration and resilience. Come sail with us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour.